Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence I've come to admire greatly, as well as his extensive personal experience with some very important pieces of our history that bear, I believe, very directly on the challenges of our own time, is our first guest. His name is Stephen Young. He is these days the Global Executive Director of the Co-Roundtable for Moral Capitalism. He's the author of two books on that subject, Moral Capitalism and The Road to Moral Capitalism. He has served as the Dean, Assistant Dean at the Harvard Law School, among other places, a professor and inspiration, I think, to generations of young people who, I believe, have benefited from his experiences, have I, and I'm very anxious to share some of those experiences with you all. Specifically, I want to pick Steve Young's brain about the impending defeat, and I don't think we can call it anything other than that, of the United States in Afghanistan. And Steve has, among his many experiences, been witness to, been personally involved in one of the last serious defeats that we sustained in Vietnam. And some of his insights about all of that are, as I say, of particular importance now as we try to think our way through what might befall us, not just friends, not just allies, but us, and what we might do to have things come out rather differently if we learn from some of our previous experiences. Steve Young, thank you for joining us today. It's good to catch up with you. It's been too long since we've spoken, but President Biden's announcement last week that we're going to be completely out of Afghanistan, militarily at least, by the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks prompts me to want to revisit with you lessons we should have learned and what we might yet do to avoid perhaps disaster. Glad to have you with us here at Secure Freedom Radio, Steve.
Thanks, Frank. It's good to be back. I want to pick up first on your use of the word completely out of Afghanistan. One of the things that I think makes this actually a surrender is a provision in the tentative draft agreement with the Taliban, which was negotiated last February, February 2020, which people can find and read. There's a commitment in there. Let me read it. It says, the United States is committed to withdraw from Afghanistan all military forces of the United States, its allies, and coalition partners. And here's the key words, including all non-diplomatic civilian personnel, private security contractors, trainers, advisors, and supporting services personnel within 14 months following the announcement of this agreement. This means that once the agreement is signed, within 14 months, 1 year, all American ways of assisting the nationalist and the moderate Afghans will disappear. They will be left entirely on their own. That's just a complete withdrawal and retreat, and I can only consider that a surrender.
Steve, you mentioned that it's a draft agreement. Has it not been formalized, and are we not now withdrawing pursuant to its terms under the Biden decision to get out by 9/11 of next year, of this year?
Frank, my understanding is, and then there are people who know more than I do, but I haven't seen any photograph in the newspaper of Americans and President Ghani and Taliban leaders signing a piece of paper. So in that sense, there's still something open-ended. But the draft has been out there a long time, and the issues have been around release of prisoners by the Afghan government versus a ceasefire, which has not been honored by the Taliban. So on the one hand, the Taliban have not even lived up to the tentative promises that they would forego violence as a goodwill gesture in order to get to a point where an agreement could be signed. And then there's supposed to be negotiations. The tentative agreement is still sort of open-ended, but it calls for, after the American withdrawal, negotiations between the Afghan government and the Taliban to form some sort of government of national union or something like that, which those kinds of negotiations at the end of a civil war usually depend on the power of the two sides. And if the Taliban think they can take over the whole country, why should they negotiate at all with the Afghan government? And if the Afghan government feels that they've been abandoned, or leading Afghans who are opposed to the Taliban, if they feel that they've been abandoned and they start to make plans to leave the country, then there'll be a collapse of morale and will on the side of the Afghan government, and that will just ease the way for the Taliban to take over village by village, district by district, and ultimately they will have Kabul itself.
And you've seen this movie before. This is very reminiscent of what happened in Vietnam, is it not?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, what happened in Vietnam was that the Americans did not demand at the end in 1972, in the private secret negotiations, the Americans did not demand the withdrawal of the North Vietnamese army. So the South Vietnamese were left with a North Vietnamese army of some 250,000, 300,000 soldiers, ultimately equipped with tanks and rockets and things like that, to fight on. The Viet Cong had been defeated, but a Trojan horse, a huge, massive Trojan horse, was left inside South Vietnam by Henry Kissinger, who then led our negotiations. And then after the Americans left, Communists gave a decent 2-year interval, and then they launched a major offensive and conquered the country. This is the same formula that we've gone into with Afghanistan.
We were unable to come to the assistance of our former Vietnamese allies, and they were completely crushed. We have to pause for just a second, Steve Young. We want to come back and talk about lessons learned and what we could do instead of surrendering in Afghanistan. But I think what you're describing here is so worrying, because the predictable consequences of what went down in Afghanistan in recent months and what is now in prospect is so reminiscent of the previous unhappy experience with Vietnam. And to think that it will come out differently this time, I think, is just a terrible mistake. We're going to drill down on the lessons that we should have learned from Vietnam and that we might yet apply to ensure that we do not experience, and those who have relied upon us do not experience, a similar fate to what befell the South Vietnamese people, as well as their military and government. And we'll talk about that and more with Steve Young of the Co-Roundtable right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're continuing our conversation with Steve Young, a man who personally was involved with and a leader of an effort in Vietnam to give the people there an alternative to the very, very unhappy prospect of life under the North Vietnamese communists, which unfortunately became their fate after Henry Kissinger essentially sold the Vietnamese out. Steve Young, you were talking about a program that we used people like you to try to help the villagers of Vietnam well, defend themselves and build a bulwark against the Viet Cong and, you know, the communists more generally. Talk a little bit about this so-called civil operations for rural development support program, CORDS, that you were involved in Vietnam, and lessons that we could learn from the experience with it.
Right. Well, I think the basic point for people to get, and we really haven't done this in Afghanistan, is that dealing with an insurgency is a combination of factors. Military, yes. Police, yes. Economic, yes. Political, yes. And most importantly, engaging the people at the bottom of society. Insurgents are an armed military force, a gang, which uses force to impose their will on people, and they recruit individuals who come in. It's a form of dictatorship, if you will, enforced by guns at the local level inside a society. It's very hard to defeat an insurgency with big military units, companies, battalions, things like that. But if the people stand up against the insurgents, they can defeat the insurgents in their own communities. So starting in 1967, the Americans and the South Vietnamese switched their strategy, their philosophy, away from a top-down military search-and-destroy approach to a bottoms-up approach of organizing each village in Vietnam to defend itself, to have its own local government, and to have its own economic development. So the rice fields would grow more rice. The ladies could have more pigs and chickens. The markets could thrive. And by 1972, the Viet Cong, the insurgency among the South Vietnamese, effectively had been defeated. There were only 25,000 left, according to the U.S. Embassy. And the same strategy could have been used any time over the last 20 years in Afghanistan. It could still be used today. The national security elite of the United States are civilian and military. I think because we lost the Vietnam War, they never bothered to see how the Viet Cong were defeated and apply that in Afghanistan. They're actually, under the current president of Afghanistan, there's some several thousand local committees, community development committees, which have been set up across the country, which could serve as the local basis for a pluralistic, democratic approach to Afghanistan, in which the Taliban could participate with their neighbors. Only they don't get to use guns to become the local dictators. That could have been done at any time. That strategy is still out there to be applied in Afghanistan. But we should probably negotiate with the Taliban now to say, we want to have some civilian people there to help you and all your fellow Afghans have a bright future. And so therefore we could partner with the Afghan government to decentralize decision-making down to the local communities and organize militias in every community.
Well, I can't imagine that would be something that the Taliban would want us to do. So I don't think negotiations are necessarily the way to get this done. But I guess what I'm really thinking, Steve, is if we recognize that surrendering the place to the Taliban will inevitably translate into not only the takeover of Afghanistan by the Taliban again, but free rein given again to fellow jihadists, notably Al-Qaeda, and probably the Islamic State as well, emboldening not only those forces there in Afghanistan, but the Islamic movement, as it's called, worldwide, to believe that the United States will be defeated. I think it's, you know, God's will that that will happen, and this will certainly seem to bear them out. But if we were to say, you know, we're not going to do that, we're not going to let that happen, especially on the symbolic occasion of the 20th anniversary of one of our earlier defeats at their hands, 9/11 and 2001. We will actually, it seems to me, desperately need an alternative plan. And something like CORDS would be the ticket. But I just can't see the Taliban agreeing that that would be a good thing for the country. They're not interested in what's good for the country. They're interested in their control and power and return to the glories of, an Islamic state there, are they not?
Frank, we have to start from where we are. And the Biden administration is basically saying we're giving up, we're getting out, and they've got this negotiated text. So the next step has to be somehow related to this negotiated text. And I would think what we should do is that we should start interpreting the text in various ways, or just saying, because you haven't done X, we're not going to do Y.
Yeah, well, that's a different thing than trying to negotiate with the Taliban changes to the terms.
But you offer the Taliban, it's sort of part of this promise. You continue to offer dialogue and negotiations and things like that. That was my thought there. But another point I want to get to your listeners is that I think there's a lot of feeling about the fatigue, particularly among the Democrats and people in the Biden administration, that, well, Afghanistan really isn't a serious problem for us. It's a little country. Al-Qaeda isn't there anymore. It's far away. They can't hurt us. What they're completely overlooking is how powers like China and Russia in particular, but also Turkey, also Iran, other people around the world, will read American surrender. I think we should remember that when the predecessors of the Taliban defeated the Soviet Union with support from the United States, we were very excited about that. We took heart from the fact that guerrillas in Afghanistan could defeat, outlast the Soviet military machine. And that gave us, that emboldened us and gave us resolve. That's going to happen with Putin and with Xi Jinping. They're going to get new resolve, thinking that the Americans now split over issues of racism and one thing and another, that we are a failing country, a culture which is in disarray. We've lost our will to persevere. Why not, from Xi's point of view, move forward to take over the South China Sea? Why not, from Biden's point of view? From Putin's point of view, Biden's already called him a killer. He doesn't like that. Why shouldn't Putin press harder on the Ukrainians to get a better deal, to sort of subordinate Ukraine even more to Russia? And it's the kind of dynamic that led Hitler to, expand and expand and expand, and then boom, we had World War II.
This is a topic to which we will return momentarily with Jeff Nyquist, who is very much of the view, as I fear am I, that we're looking at a new world war in prospect, as some of these bad actors, and you can throw in Iran and almost certainly China's proxy North Korea as well, seizing the opportunity to make aggressive gains at our expense and that of the free world more generally. If they are emboldened further by signs of our weakness and irresolution. And I think there's no getting around it. That is the takeaway from this. So, Steve, we've got another minute and a half left. Quickly, if we were to adopt a cords-like approach, do we also need to do something that would help assure the military capabilities of the Afghan army are sustained while this cords option is exercised and capabilities are built up?
Absolutely, absolutely. What we didn't mention earlier is that a cords process of local development and defense fits under an umbrella of military force. The genius of cords was to integrate a military search and destroy strategy with a village development strategy. So the two have to be integrated very closely. And there has to be a centralized command on both sides at the national level. You don't divide the military off from the civilians. You integrate them together because society, as we know, needs both order and security and opportunities for development.
But we need not do that the way we've been waging the war in Afghanistan. And on another occasion, we hope to have Eric Prince back with us to talk about other ways of possibly providing that military support through contractors rather than a big U.S. military presence. So there's a way to reduce what many of us are fatigued with, namely the costs and personnel there.
The agreement last year has given up on that. We've said we're not going to have any contracts.
Well, this is why I says I say we're going to have to, I think, well, you've put it, reinterpret, if not jettison this agreement entirely. And that may be a stretch for the Biden administration, but the alternative is, I think, very perilous indeed. Steve Young, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for all you've done for our country and are continuing to do at the Co-Roundtable. I hope you'll come back to us with updates on all of this very soon. In the meantime, stay well.
Love you, Frank. Thanks again.
Next up, we'll speak with Steve Sukup about the dictatorship of woke capital in practice and what it means for you right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Steven Sukup. He is the vice president and publisher of The Political Forum, which is an independent research provider delivering research and consulting services to the institutional investment community specifically. But more to the point, he is the author of a terrific new book. It's entitled The Dictatorship of Woke Capital: How Political Correctness Captured Big Business. We've had him on to talk about it before, but the insights that he has shared with us in that book have become more and more important and, I think, indisputable in light of what we're now seeing in the way of so-called woke capital at work in the state of Georgia, among other places. And I wanted to get him back to talk about that and more. Steve, it's good to have you back. Welcome once more to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you for having me, Frank.
Talk a little bit about what we're seeing now being wielded against the state of Georgia and their democracy.
Well, I think that the people of Georgia have been under attack from woke capital and from large corporations for quite some time. I think if we all sit down and try to figure out why they would target Georgia, we could come up with several reasons. The most obvious being that they think it's a state that they can lampoon pretty easily. But the attacks on Georgia actually began in 2016 with Georgia's passage of a religious freedom bill. They continued in 2019 with the passage of a fetal heartbeat law. And now they've begun again with the passage of a ballot integrity law in Georgia.
But remind us, Steve, when you use the term woke capital, who are you talking about and what are its characteristics that are now, as you say, being wielded serially against the people of Georgia?
Well, woke capital is a top-down anti-democratic strategy that is employed by some of the biggest and best-known names in business to change the way business functions, to change the definition of capitalism, and to change forever the relationship between the citizen and the state. And I think what we're seeing in Georgia is a very clear example of how they intend to change the relationship between the citizen and the state and how they intend to wield their anti-democratic beliefs.
This is of such moment, of course, because it's now being used to essentially prevent, or try to prevent at least, election reform that is manifestly needed in Georgia, both as an exercise in fundamentally transforming Georgia, I think it's fair to say, but also really against other states that are similarly engaged in rethinking election integrity laws, but also at the national level, a piece of legislation that's hurtling down the tracks in the Senate now, known by S1, its designator, that would permanently establish federal statutes restricting states' ability to impose things like voter ID. How is this larger agenda being served by the present attack of woke capital against Georgia?
Well, As I said, I think Georgia is, in many ways, you know, sort of the Luca Brasi of American states. They've thrown him in the river and sent his Georgia's vest you know, wrapped in a fish and a newspaper to the rest of the states and to the representatives in Congress saying, hey, Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes, and we'll do the same to you if you don't, you know, get with the program. So I think that this is mob tactics being directed at legislators throughout the country at the federal and the state level, warning them to do what the woke capitalists want or suffer the repercussions.
Unfortunately, this is not the full extent of their agenda, and it's now playing out in not just corporate boardrooms, as you describe in your book, The Dictatorship of Woke Capital, Steve Sukup, but also in the Securities and Exchange Commission. There's been a very interesting back and forth between the new chairman of the SEC, Gary Gensler, and one of the commissioners, a Republican by the name of Hester Peirce. Talk a little bit about what's going on there with this so-called environment, social justice, governance agenda.
When it became fairly clear that Joe Biden was going to be elected president in November, that the counts would go in his favor, we predicted that one of the things that would happen behind the scenes but be most pernicious to our country, to big business, to capital markets, was the overt politicization of the financial bureaucracies that have long been seen by both parties as beyond politics, the Federal Reserve and especially the SEC. And we couldn't have been more right about that. As soon as President Biden took office and made Allison Herron Lee the acting chair of the SEC, Ms. Lee began moving very, very aggressively toward essentially changing the materiality standards for corporations in this country, which is an enormous deal. It doesn't sound like much, but it's an enormous deal.
What does that mean, changing the materiality standards for the layperson?
Materiality, what is considered material for a company are basically their financial condition.
Or at least that's the way it's worked up till now.
Since 1944, that's what's been considered material, except that now Chairman Gensler and Commissioner Lee and the entire Biden administration are pushing to make environmental and eventually diversity standards reportable and to make them de facto, if not de jure, material, which would change the standard and really do severe damage to our capital market.
So again, just to put this in layman's terms, these are ways in which they can influence corporate behavior as well as how the public perceives the risks associated with investing in those companies. If you've got a good ESG, as it's called, score, that is presumably meant to mean you're a sound investment entity, even if your financials aren't so good. Is that how it could work, Steve Sukup?
That's exactly how it could work. And that's, as you mentioned, Commissioner Peirce has been very outspoken about the damage that she believes that this could do to investors and to capital markets more generally. She's very concerned about what this will do and how this could play out in the future, because it really changes the definition of what a good investment is.
Yeah. And it fits this sort of larger transformation, which again, you chronicled in Dictatorship of the Woke Capital, namely the idea that there are people to whom businesses need to be accountable other than their shareholders. Talk a little bit about how the stakeholders fit into this and reinforce this, fundamental transformation of capitalism that seems to be underway.
Right. Stakeholders, generally, you know, the whole stakeholder-shareholder debate is actually a false dichotomy that the left has created. Every successful business considers its stakeholders. If it didn't, it wouldn't be in business for long. What the left has done, however, is to make it seem as if the stakeholders are more important than the shareholders, and that there is a moral obligation on the part of business to serve these stakeholders first and foremost, which is very, you know, radically different from the way corporations have always functioned.
Meaning not necessarily focused on making a profit for the benefit of the people who own the company, but serving other social agendas or values. And Steve Sukup, let me just quickly introduce a topic to which I hope we might return with you in the near future, because we talked a little bit about how this is manifesting itself in Georgia, this sort of mafia enforcement of a social justice agenda, for want of a better term. But it also seems as though it's now beginning to really metastasize into other industries too. And we all are familiar with, you know, how the tech giants, for example, are all about this. But one thing that was called to my attention the other day was some of the terms of service that Microsoft has adopted. And it's not the only one, but it's a particularly egregious example in which it seems as though if you're going to use their products, you're going to have to conform or give them permission to use your information, perhaps even disseminate your information without your explicit permission or your wish to have them do so. Talk a little bit about how this could really transform the relationship between the consumer and these tech giants, these woke capitalists.
Well, not only can it transform that relationship, it can transform the way people think, the way they feel comfortable expressing themselves. You know, if you buy a new version of Microsoft Office and you save something in Word, the default save location is OneDrive, which is your personal OneDrive, you know, for safety reasons. Well, Microsoft has access to that. Microsoft doesn't necessarily have access to your personal hard drive, but if you save everything to OneDrive, then, you know, there it is. They have access to everything you've ever written, you know, in an email or in Word or Excel, whatever. And they can use that as the terms of service allow them to for whatever purposes they choose.
If they see you as having violated some social norm, for example, if you have engaged in some sort of statement that they consider to be either misleading or fraudulent, I mean, it is unbelievable. And as I say, Steve, I hope you'll come back and have a further drill down on this, because it seems to me that since this is effectively a monopoly, Microsoft's, you know, Outlook and Office products, we need a public outcry against what is in the offing here, because it will have very far-reaching dictatorial aspects to it, I fear, and further validate your warnings about what woke capital is up to. Thank you for your time today, Steve Sukup, as well as the great work that you do at the Political Forum. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon for this purpose. Next up, we'll talk with J.R. Nyquist about Russia, China, and you, and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, and we're joined by J.R. Nyquist, a brilliant strategic thinker and essayist whose work you could find at jrnyquist.blog. You can also periodically see him in the Epic Times and other great outlets. He is also the author of a number of really important books, including The Origins of the Fourth World War and The Fool and His Enemy. It's always good to have him with us. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to talk with you about something I touched on at the end of my conversation just now with Steve Sukup, because I gather you're as concerned about it as I am, and that is this idea that woke capitalists at Microsoft, which would include, of course, Bill Gates, are in the process of changing the terms of service for those of us, and it seems probably just about all of us, who use Microsoft's Office products for various purposes, business perhaps, business personal, you know, whatever. We are now going to have to give them, Microsoft, the right to obtain and read and perhaps utilize in whatever way they see fit, including disseminate, our personal information, the material that we put on their products. What is up with that, as you see it? How serious a problem is it for the kind of free society and freedoms like freedom of speech that we take for granted, too many of us?
Well, I mean, you take a product that's so universally used, like Microsoft Word, and you suddenly say, change the terms of agreement that everything now that you've written in Microsoft Word now is owned by us. And if you're a writer, if you've been writing things for 20 or 30 years and you've got them all saved in Microsoft Word documents, whatever version of Word you go back to, what are you going to do? You're going to go find all those documents and change them to some different kind of program? Is that practical? Just the idea that they can do something like that is shocking.
It is shocking. And I think it is such an affront to our privacy and our First Amendment freedoms that I hope that we will be able to enlist the millions, the tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of Americans who will find their privacy invaded, their personal First Amendment freedoms infringed upon, to join us in opposing this kind of action by I'd call it a monopoly, not just an oligopoly. Let me turn to another topic that I know you have been writing about, I presume in Word, Jeff Nyquist, namely your concerns that what is teeing up with the Russians and Chinese may be a new world war. You've written a book on the subject. Walk us through why you are concerned that that may be in the offing at the moment.
Well, there's a number of signs that are bad. One is that Russia and China are mobilizing at the same time for what appears to be a war in Ukraine for Russia, and a war in, possibly an attack on Taiwan or something in the Far East on the part of China. But of course, Russia is mobilizing in the Far East and in the Arctic at the same time. But the thing that bothers me is some people may have noticed, is that Russia and China concluded an agreement in January to combine their anti-ballistic missile defense systems, which includes tracking and air defense systems. The Chinese operate the S-400 and S-300 dual-purpose SAM ABM systems, and so do the Russians. They even have the S-500 system. So when you combine your anti-ballistic missile systems, you are in effect allying in terms of a missile war, of a larger war, and of an air war. So this is extremely alarming and signals a very real military alliance between Russia and China.
And that alliance would be troubling in its own right. But as you say, Jeff, there are indications that they are anticipating or planning on perhaps preparing to execute a simultaneous two-front operation that would essentially render the United States and perhaps its friends and allies incapable of responding to either of these threats effectively. Is that your concern?
That is interesting, yes, indeed, because the U.S. is a global power responsible for helping to defend NATO and to defend countries like Japan and Australia and South Korea in the Far East, so in the Pacific. So it is very alarming because China and Russia can cover each other. If you have trouble simultaneously going on in the Far East, in the South China Sea, or in Ukraine in the Black Sea, The U.S. is now so overpowered. I mean, to give you an example, the Chinese Navy is, over 350 ships now with 130 major surface combatants and outnumbers us in submarines. So their Navy alone outnumbers our Navy, let alone the fact that we have responsibilities in the Mediterranean, the Persian Gulf, and the North Atlantic. So our Navy under 300 ships is stretched all over this. So we have this serious problem. And of course, this is what's being taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm. And if we were to try to move some of our assets, naval assets that are in the European theater or North Atlantic into the Pacific to contend with a contingency out there, we would have to go through the Panama Canal, at least to make the shortest transit. And that is, of course, controlled by the Chinese. It could be certainly physically controlled. It's a problem that we would almost certainly confront if we were engaged in hostilities against them. Let me ask you about this, Jeff. If you look at what the Chinese have been doing to prepare for this moment, you mentioned 300 ships. I was struck by something that you had in a piece about whether Russia and China are in the process of igniting a third world war. I believe it was a sociologist by the name of Li Yi who talked about the speed with which the Chinese are building up those naval capabilities. It was quite a stunning statistic. Talk about that.
He gave a presentation in Shenzhen last fall in which he said that in terms of tonnage, the Chinese are building a navy equivalent to the French navy every year and have done so for the last several years and can do so for the next decade. So that is, and the French, they have an aircraft carrier and about 35 warships, the tonnage of which, this is an entire French fleet. Every year they're adding to their size.
It's staggering. And it seems certain that the Chinese will be increasing their deployments of those naval forces far beyond the Western Pacific, but they are certainly in a position to be the dominant naval power out there right now, which is, of course, of concern should they move against Taiwan, which does seem to be in the offing. Let me ask you about one other piece of this that you've also talked about, and that is the interest that the Russians and the Chinese are both expressing. And here their interests may diverge a bit, that remains to be seen. In the Arctic, what are the implications should they, in fact, either one of those powers, jointly or severally, secure a dominant position up there?
Yeah, I think the so-called disagreement between China and Russia over the Arctic is silly, and it's some kind of a game, a joke at our expense. But the Russians have been building their icebreaker fleets. And there was talk in Russia towards the end of summer and during the early fall about having a capability of moving their fleet from Murmansk across the ice to Alaska in the Bering Strait, so that they could unite their fleet with the Chinese fleet in the Pacific, which is a very interesting capability for Russia to have, which would add
making the force disparities even greater if they were to operate jointly against us. And the resources that are there in the Arctic are, of course, something that the Russians especially have had their eye on for some time. How close would you say they are to being able to essentially preclude others from having access to that region should they decide to do so?
Well, the Russians have a very sophisticated submarine fleet, speaking about operating under the ice. And of course, they have moved air power and missiles up there, even onto some islands and places up there that are kind of interesting. So they have been, in as far as pushing air bases and increasing air strength, they are really becoming dominant in the Arctic.
This is a topic to which we will return with you, Jeff Nyquist, as it has very far-reaching implications. Our own ability to transit the region, our assets and equities in Alaska, among other things, are on the line. Thank you for these very important, if very ominous, comments, Jeff, and for joining us each week. We value your participation in this program tremendously. Keep up the good work at jrnyquist.blog. Check it out, folks. And I hope that you will come back to us all again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.